Right, thank you very much. Arif, I've no idea how to follow that song, so I'm going to launch right in. So this is a sort of difficult talk to give because I'm essentially, it's a book sort of length project I've been working on at the moment called Choosing to Changing Selves. I'll explain a bit about what it is, but giving a talk based on a book, especially when so the book came about because I started writing this as a paper, it got to 70 pages, and it got to 90 pages, and then I sort of thought Noah was going to take that. In the end it turned out a book publisher would take it. And so I wasn't quite sure how to excerpt stuff from it. But fortunately, Arif has a starring role in the book in one of the later chapters talking about temporal discounting. So what I'm going to do is talk about the general question the book's trying to answer, give what will have to be an incredibly brief sketch of my attempt to answer it. And then Arif enters later on when I'm trying to answer a particular objection to the style of answer that I give to it. I'll try to mainly focus on that, which hopefully has interest for everybody, but we'll be addressing this particular component. Okay, so here are the three sort of inspirations for the book project. So roughly the project comes around from the following problem. Rational decision theory, or rational choice theory, or the theory of how we should rationally make decisions, stated informally, says something like you should choose, or what is rational for you to choose is determined partly by what you believe, your degrees of belief if you're doing kind of standard rational choice theory, and what you value, which is now standardly encoded in your utilities. But that's a common experience, is that your utilities, your values, the things that you ascribe values in the world change over time. What you ascribe values in the world changes over time. You might value certain things as a younger person, other things as an older person. Certain particular extreme experiences might lead you to change the values that you assign. And so the question then becomes, when rational choice theory says that what determines what you should rationally choose is what you believe and what you value, the question becomes, well, what you value at what time? Is it the time at which you make the decision? Is that the final word of the matter? Or does what the sort of decision-making utilities that you use, the values that you use in your rational decision-making, should they take into account what you will value at later times? Should they also take into account what you value at earlier times? And if they should, how do you weigh those different values at different times up against each other? So that's the general sort of problem. And these three philosophers, so Laurie Paul, Edmund Ullmann Margulis, and Christopher Bickfist, have all asked questions around this sort of arena. But in all cases, actually, they've focused on really quite particular instances of this problem. So Laurie, for instance, is interested in a situation where the change in values comes around as a result of an acute experience, and particularly the phenomenal character of that acute experience. So one of our classic examples is becoming a parent and holding your child for the first time, and that experience, she thinks, changes, or for many people, changes what they value. And then the Margulis looks at this in a slightly broader situation. She's interested where particular actions that you perform leads you to change your values, but not because they bring about a kind of a single experience that leads you to change your values, but perhaps for other sorts of reasons. So, for instance, you might choose to move to a different country, and that country may have different cultural values, and you might gradually assimilate yourself to those cultural values, and as a result of that, your values change. But that's not because of a single acute experience, not a single instantaneous experience, but rather a period. And Bickfist is interested, it's sort of interested in the question, I'm interested in sort of the more general question, how do you write a decision theory when for people whose values change over the course of your life? But he's interested in looking at a sort of coarse-grained version of the problem, where you represent individuals just as having preferences, and so just an order between different possibilities, whereas I'm going to be looking at a more fine-grained representation of individuals as having choices. There are relationships between those two, but Bickfist is just interested in the case where you can represent them only as having preferences. Okay, so to illustrate the problem, here's just a couple of examples. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly for time reasons. But I might focus just on this one because it really gets to the heart of the problem we're interested in. So here is a Mary, and she is making a decision at the current time about what career she's going to pursue. She's either going to become a police officer or she's going to become a conservation officer. And this is, these are her current values. So she knows that becoming a police officer will require quite a lot of conformism. She'll have to follow a set of protocols that aren't set down by her and will require her to conform to those. Being a conservation officer, she'll also have to follow certain rules set down by the local council or something like that, but she'll have a lot more freedom within those constraints to exercise her own self-expression. And currently she values self-expression quite a bit more than conformism, and so she values becoming a conservation officer more than becoming a police officer. However, she has read the empirical evidence, particularly due to Anna Bardi at Holloway, who's carried out studies on this, and has learned that taking on a career, people often socialise their values to the values that would be appropriate for that career. So the reason I chose this particular example is that Bardi has studies on people in police training who are, and shows that people in fact come to value conformism much more after at the end of their police training than they did at the beginning. So Anari knows that were she to choose to become a police officer, so this is her becoming a police officer, her values will in fact change, and she'll come to value conformism quite a bit more than self-expression, and therefore value the career that she in fact chose quite a lot more than the career that she did it. However, if she becomes a conservation officer, there's not very much for her values to socialise to, and in fact this might not be one of the careers where your values do socialise too much, and so she retains the same values, we might think, across this period. So if she were to choose to be a police officer, if she choose to be a conservation officer, she'll do what her current values say, and also what her values will say where she come to be a conservation officer. But if she becomes a police officer, while she'll go against her current values, she'll come to do something which she values really quite a lot more, having done that thing. And the question really is, for Anari, what is it that she should do in that sort of situation? Okay, I've got some other examples, but we'll move on. So there are sort of three existing solutions to this at the moment, and I'll just run through these briefly so that we can get on to the solution I'm proposing and then the subjection to it I want to talk about. The first is that really there's no problem here at all. Despite what you think, you don't actually change your values across time. So you can imagine a situation, so when people make this point, they make it by analogy with a sort of situation in which it seems like your tastes change. So for instance, you can imagine that at the beginning of the week I have much greater value in having strawberry ice cream over pear ice cream, but come to the end of the week I have much greater value in pear ice cream over strawberry ice cream. In that situation, it's quite natural, I think, to say that really what you value hasn't changed, but rather what it is in the world that gives you the thing that you value has changed. So in that sort of situation, you might say that throughout, you in fact assign the same level of value to a certain sort of gustatory pleasure, but what gives you that gustatory pleasure has changed over the course of the week. And I think that's quite a natural sort of response in case of taste changes. So if you notice in the case of Anari, it doesn't look like what's changing is the value she assigns to something you might call tastes. These look like much deeper sorts of values, the value you assign to conformism, the value you can assign to self-expression. So I don't think this sort of solution, I think, works in cases where you've got to choose whether someone delivers pear ice cream to your office on Friday or strawberry ice cream to your office on Friday. In that case, you should simply pay attention to what your values will be on Friday, what it is that's going to give you the thing that you value on Friday. That's not going to be the case for Anari, okay? So an analogous thing would be to say she should choose whatever career it is that once she has it, she'll give most value to, so essentially become the police officer. One problem with it is just that it seems like it gives far too much weight to these future selves. And it also seems to give sort of counterintuitive examples where you can simply make a choice that will choice to do something that you it's going to give extreme disvalue to at the time, so you can imagine Anari really gives extreme disvalue to conformity at the first time. But that sort of unchanging utility solution would end up saying, well, even if she, if by choosing that she gets to have much greater value and being a Kuznetsov by the end, she should do that. Yeah.
Sorry, could I just ask, because I'm not, aren't the figures just ordinals or are they cardinal? I mean, as you've got that diagram, it looks as though utilities are greater, that is,
yeah.
10 in beats 6 and 4 beats 2. Does that matter to the story, or...?
Yes, yeah, so I'm imagining that these are utilities on some cardinal scale. So just in the sort of standard decision theory way, these are not unique. They're unique up to affine transformations, so they're unique up to scaling. So, but we're imagining these are all measured on the same scale. So yes, this being higher does, then this does matter. These are all supposed to be measured on the same scale. And there's a question about comparison of utilities across the different cells, but so I can talk about that. But yes, this is supposed to be that were she to become a police officer, the value she would assign to being a police officer there is greater than the value she would assign to being a conservation officer to become that. Yeah, so I like the... Yeah, is that, that's the... Sorry. Okay. Okay. So, like I said, I'm just going to run through these pretty quickly. That's the first sort of solution. The first solution sort of says, look, really nothing changes. It's just that what it is in the world that gives you the things that you value change. So essentially what happens in Anari's case is what it is that gives her value change, but her own values don't change, and therefore she should just choose whatever it would be that would give her value at the time that she gets it. And I think there are problems with that. The second solution is due to the Margulis. It's the utility, or higher order utility solution. And it essentially just says, choose whatever it is that your higher order utilities say you should do. So it's not just the case that you have values. You don't just assign values to particular ways the world could be. You also assign values to having those particular values. Those are your sort of second order values. And Edelman Margulis thinks that you should choose based on those second order values. So you should choose in order to become the sort of person who has the values that you currently think are the right sort of values to have. So for instance, here at the start, Anari doesn't just value conformism, she also values being the sort of person who values conformism much more than being... values self-expression, she also values being the sort of person who values self-expression. And so... according to Edelman Margulis, she should move then this way, and she should, in order to continue being the sort of person that she approves of. The problem with this is it looks like the same problem just returns, because our first order values and our second order values will often just change in lockstep with one another. So as Anari's first order values change, as she socializes becoming a police officer, it's not just that her values will change, she'll probably, I mean, this is speculation, but it doesn't seem implausible to assume that also her second order values will change in step with that. So she'll also come to approve of being someone who values conformism. And so the same question comes back. If the answer is, when you're choosing for changing cells, you should choose according to, choosing in order to become the sort of person you approve of, the question becomes, well, the sort of person you approve of at what time? So just as the question was, which values should I attend to when I'm making my decision at the earlier time, the question now becomes, which second order values should I attend to, my current ones or my later ones, if they're also going to change. The other problem with this is that it seems to assume that second order utilities will trump first order utilities. So it seems to assume that if there's some discrepancy between them, some inconsistency between what you value and what your second order and what you value valuing, then you should pay attention only to the higher order ones. But there's another way to resolve that sort of tension, namely by changing the higher order ones and paying attention to the lower order ones. So I don't think that sort of solution is going to work either. And finally, I'm going to talk too quickly about this, because there's a number of subtle variations within this view, but we can come back to that if people are interested. Another natural view is essentially the objectivist view, the view that says, look, there's really one true utility function out there. That's the way in which it's a simplification. A lot of objectivists don't think there's one true utility function. They think there's a set of different permissible ones. But the think that there's essentially one true utility function, and that you should, that essentially the problem of choosing for changing cells is an epistemic problem. What really happens as you change, what looks like you change your subjective values over time, really what you change is your opinions about what the objective values are. So really what happens when Anne-Marie becomes a police officer is not that she actually changes some subjective values, but rather that she comes to believe more strongly that the correct, the one true, objective values are ones that value conforms on. The problem is that it just looks like this is too demanding. It looks like a sort of, we can come up with a number of different conflicts of value that don't look like there are these objective facts to tell between them. Between conformism and self-expression. Some people will take the sort of extreme view that there's a matter of fact as to which of those is more valuable. But it looks like in that sort of case, there isn't going to be this sort of objective fact in the world to underpin this response. You can imagine lots of different ways that a life could go, each of which you might think are sort of incomparable when it comes to their value, becoming someone who kind of lives the life of the mind versus someone who lives a much more physical, practical, hands-on life. These don't look like the sort of things where there could be a fact of the matter as to which one's more valuable in order to get the objective utility solution going. Okay, so that's sort of problem. That's the problem with those three, extremely brief. The solution I want to put forward is essentially sees the problem as a judgment aggregation problem. Now, I recognise this has become a sort of fashionable thing to do, but I might have didn't realise it was a fashionable thing to do in philosophy until I started doing it myself. But essentially the idea is, when you're making a choice, when I'm making a choice on behalf of myself, I'm essentially making a choice on behalf of a corporate entity made up of the different selves. In my future, my present self, and my past selves. And these different selves that make up that corporate entity that's me have different values, different attitudes, in this case, different utilities. And in that sort of bit, we have a framework in which to solve problems like that, where you've got a group of individuals, we have different attitudes, perhaps different preferences, perhaps different beliefs, perhaps different probabilities, and the question becomes, how should you make a decision on the basis of that? This is the sort of basis of voting theory and judgment aggregation theory in general. And so essentially what I'm proposing is that we should treat this as a judgment aggregation problem, and so we should give a judgment aggregation solution to it. What I should choose is the way I should choose is to aggregate the judgments of my present, my future, my past selves in some way, and then make the decision using that aggregated judgment. Okay, so the idea is that each of my selves has their own values, my selves in different at different times and in different situations has their own values. But I shouldn't choose just on the basis of the values I have now. I should choose on the basis of some decision-making values, which are some sort of aggregate of the values that I have in these different possible worlds. So I'm just going to, again, in the interest of time, I'm going to go through this very quickly just to sketch out what the solution is, but I won't go into much more detail about it. So the idea is this. In decision theory, when you're trying to choose between two different actions, as we are, say, here, between becoming a police officer and becoming a conservation officer, you look at those two actions individually, you end up assigning a value to each of those actions, it's usually calculated as the expected utility of the action, and then you see which of those is greater, and you should essentially choose the one that maximises, or one of the ones that maximises. And that's what I'm going to... So in this situation, suppose I'm evaluating becoming a police officer, I want to assign a value to this whole state of the world.
It was done at 2, so I
didn't
know
why
I'm doing it again.
Okay, so I feel like you should come up with fire ups. So we're evaluating this whole state. Now, typically in utility theory, when you're evaluating a state of the world, what that state of the world specifies is just how the world is really beyond the agent. That's the normal way in which it's done. But for our purposes, we wanted to specify not just the way the world is beyond agent, but also what the agent's values are at different times in the world. So in this case, it specifies what values she assigns to these to the Pembroke Peace Officer, the Pembroke Conservation Officer, what values she assigns to the Pembroke Peace Officer and Conservation Officer at the later time as well. And when you want to evaluate this state, what you do is you essentially take some weighted average of the utilities that she has in the outcome, which is the Pembroke Peace Officer, at the earlier time and at the later time. So her utility, and Mary's utility for the state of the world, which consists of becoming a police officer, having these values and being a police officer at the beginning, these values at the end, will be some sort of weighted average of these two. Now the question is, when you're taking a weighted average, how do you set the weights? Okay, so I've given an example here. I might give 0.7 to her, she might give 0.7 to her current self, 0.3 to her future self. But the kind of, I'm going to sketch out this solution, but the main sort of second stage of the project is to specify how it is that you should specify these ways of weighting, and that's what I'm going to come on to later when I talk about Arik's work. Okay. So when she's evaluating this state of the world, she just takes the values that she has in that state of the world at the different times and takes some weighted average of them. That's an aggregate. And this is a standard way of aggregating people's utilities in this framework. Turns out there are all sorts of problems. There are impossibility theorems around here, results you've got to overcome, and sections trying to argue why this is the right way to overcome it, but it's not true. Okay. And then if she's doing evaluating the other possibility where she chooses to become a conservation officer, well, she does the same thing, or the analogous thing. She takes the value that she assigns to doing that at the earlier time, and later time she takes a weighted average. In this case, of course, she doesn't change, in fact, the values that she has at the earlier and later time, and so whatever weighted average she takes, it's going to be 6. But here I've given slightly different weights to the earlier time or later time. And that's just to show that you might be giving different weights to different selves depending on the state that you're evaluating. For instance, one consideration that might go into your assigning weights is how close the values of the future self lie to your current self, sort of proximity consideration. And so that would lead, in this case, for instance, she should be able to end up assigning greater weight to the future self than she did in the earlier case, where her future self is further away from her in terms of its values. Okay, so in this extremely simple example, she ends up evaluating becoming a conservation officer as better than becoming a police officer, and that's what we should choose to do. Of course, if she'd given a lot more weight to her future self in that first case, then unsurprisingly, she's going to end up evaluating being a police officer as better. And so the question really becomes, how do you assign those weights? That's just supposed to illustrate the idea. When you're making a decision in this judgment aggregation solution that I'm discussing, you look at all the different states of the possible states of the world that might eventuate from your action. Each of those states of the world specifies not just what happens in the world, like I become a police officer, but also what values you have at the different times throughout the world. So I become a police officer and I have this value on Monday, and this value next Monday, and this value the following Monday. And in order to evaluate one of those states of the world specified like this, you then take a weighted average of the values you have in that state of the world across the duration of that state of the world. Do the standard expected utility calculation on it, and that's how you should do your decision theory. So I'm not going to go in, I've got a sort of illustration of how you do this in gory detail, but we don't need to go into that. So I will skip that. Okay. So that's informative, but a brief sketch of the solution I'm interested in, this judgment aggregation solution. Essentially, the thought behind it is that you should treat yourself making a decision as a corporate entity made up of your future self, your past self, and your present self, and you should be making a decision based on that, and so you want to use some sort of judgment aggregation technique in order to make that decision, much in the same way as when we're deciding who to elect as Prime Minister, we aggregate the judgments of everybody in the polity that's concerned and And aggregate them in some way using some sort of voting method and come up with the final result. And essentially what I'm suggesting there is it's not quite a voting method because it's more fine-grained than that. But that's the general idea. Okay, so how do you set the weight? So essentially what I wanted to explore in the second part of the project, second half of the book, is using essentially a Parfitian account of how you set the weight. So Parfit has this idea that you should assign greater weight to your future self the more connected you are to that future self. And for Parfit, that connectedness comes about, arises, based entirely in the degree of psychological overlap between you and the later self. So how many of the psychological, I mean very roughly or crudely, how many of the psychological states my current self has are shared with this future self? The more, the greater the weight they should have. But it seems to me that actually there's much, it's not just the psychological overlap that is important here, but other sorts of connections. So for instance, in one of the suggestions, I claim that you can have obligations to past selves. Actions of past selves can create obligations that future selves then have to live up to, in much the same way that we can create obligations to other members of society that we live in. So that's one suggestion. We've also got Parfit suggestion, psychological overlap. That's one way in which you should consider your weight. And then the other one I suggested or mentioned earlier on, the proximity in your values, so I should perhaps give greater weight to future selves that have values closer to mine. That's sort of, I mean, in each of these cases, in a way, we're doing a reverse of what Parfit was suggesting. Parfit had this sort of idea that you might start off with the way that you think about your other selves that make up you, the individual person, you. You should look at those and then notice that the connections you have to those other selves are also connections that you might have to selves of what you think of as other people, and therefore the sort of obligations that you might have to those future selves or considerations of what look like prudence can actually bleed out into considerations of moral considerations by other people. In a sense, what we're doing here is the opposite. We're taking a lead from our moral treatment of others, and we're suggesting that similar sorts of considerations arise when I think about my other selves. So whereas Parfit thinks, actually, you should think about other people often in similar ways to how you think about your other selves, here I'm suggesting we should think about other selves often in the same sort of way we should think about other people, so that we can have creations, obligations can be created by our past selves that our future selves have to live up to, and also this is a sort of nearest and dearest sort of consideration in the inter-self case. Okay, so psychological overlap leads us to this. Now, I'm not doing it, I'm sorry. Okay, so it's going to have to be quite straight. Sorry if I'm not going to the dentist this week. So a standard phenomenon we have is that we discount the future. So we prefer to have bad things further off in the future than to have them near to us in the future, and we prefer to have good things near to us in the future. So I prefer to have my dental treatment in 3 weeks' time rather than 1 week's time. I prefer to have a chocolate box now rather than 2 weeks' time. Even though the commodities that I get are exactly the same in the two situations, then in some sense, as Parfit puts it, nearby. Okay. Now, there's a long tradition, in fact, of Plato suggesting that this is irrational in all cases, that any sort of temporal bias of this sort is irrational. Plato thinks it's essentially like assuming that something's smaller just because it looks smaller when it's further away. And he thinks there's a certain similar irrationality going on. Economists have been very, very slightly more liberal than that. They've allowed that there are very certain situations in which it's in fact rational to do it. And they've specified those precisely. And they've given a particular argument for that. They've shown that if you don't discount the future in this very particular way that they think is rationally permissible, then you can be you're exploitable. What that means is that there are decisions that you will make at two different times in your life, which will, so your things you can, so there exists two decision problems that you'll face one at one time, one at a later time. And what you will do in that situation is you will choose two different ones. So you'll face at one time a decision problem, a decision say between A1 and B1. And at the second time, you'll choose a decision between A2 and B2. These are just actions that you can accept. And if you don't discount the future in this very, very particular way, but come and say it's fine, then you will choose A over B, and you'll choose A1 over B1, and you'll choose A2 over B2. But you can show that had you picked B1 and B2, you would, in fact, at all times, have ended up better off. You would have had more commodities than you would otherwise have had. So this is their way of arguing for why you should discount in this very particular way. Now I'm going to speed through how this way is. So So in example of discounting, you want to specify how much you discount the future. Okay. So how much often, for instance, someone on Monday, me on Monday, will prefer getting one lolly on Wednesday to getting two lollies on Thursday. And what that means, we'll say, is our discount rate between Wednesday and Thursday is half. That is, I'm indifferent between this situation and this situation. Okay. So, and the idea is, and this is sort of a crude way of viewing it, but it's helpful, is that on Monday, the utility I assign to us, here's a state of the world where I get two lollies on Tuesday, one lolly on Wednesday, four lollies on Friday. But my utility for that is the is my utility for getting two lollies, and we assume that that doesn't change, we have the same utility at all times. And then how much I discount on Monday the things that I get on Tuesday, discount how much on Monday I discount the things I would get on Wednesday. Use that to discount the utilities I get from the different commodities I get at these different times, and that gives me my utility at that time. We're also going to just assume here that my utility is linear in ice cream, at least for the amounts that we're talking about, up to four or five lollies. And here are some constraints that you might have on a discount function. So first one is called delay consistency, and this says that at any particular time, how much you discount between a later time t1 plus some interval and t1 is going to be the same as the amount, the rate of your discount between t2 plus that interval and t2. So just to, it'd be better just to illustrate these using the diagrams. So the idea is this. Suppose I'm indifferent between one lolly on Monday, I'm indifferent between one lolly on Tuesday and two lollies on Wednesday. Then I should also be indifferent between one lolly on Thursday and two lollies on Friday. And that's because the interval between these two and the amount that I get at different times is the same. And that's all that's happened is it's been shifted forward in time or backward in time. Time consistency does the other thing. So this says that suppose on Monday I'm indifferent between one lolly on Thursday and two lollies on Friday, then that should remain true on Wednesday. So where I'm standing shouldn't make any difference to my discount rate. The time at which I have it shouldn't make any difference to the discount rate. And finally, stationarity is another constraint. And this says that the discounts you have should look the same from any point in time. So if on Monday I think one on Tuesday is the same as two on Wednesday, then that should also be true if I just shift everything forward. So the way that it's sometimes put, it shouldn't matter what the precise dates are. All that should matter really are the relative position of the times and commodities at that point. So Strotz in 1955 showed the following thing, which is that these three principles are related in an intimate way. This is a less interesting part of this result. So if stationarity is true, namely the sort of timelessness of the discounting, then time consistency, the second one we had, is equivalent to delay consistency. But what's more important, the more important theorem was that if you if you satisfy stationarity, then you're unexploitable. That is, you can't get a situation like this if and only if you satisfy delay consistency. Okay. And remember, exploitability is meant to be some sort of sign of irrationality. That's going to be a key factor. Okay, so here, then so Arif. So Arif has this beautiful argument that shows that, I think decisively shows that, if you're discounting as Parfitian, that is, if the amount by which you discount some future time tracks the psychological connectedness between yourself now and that future time, then you're going to end up violating something like delay consistency. And the idea is something like this. In order to satisfy delay consistency, me now, on the 1st of January 2018, is going to have to discount the same amount between here and here, the ratio of my discount factor of this to this. It's got to be the same as the ratio of my discount factor from here to here. But, Arif argues, it's not going to be the case that the degree of my psychological connectedness between here and here has the same ratio as my degree of my psychological connectedness between here and here. Why not? Well, because there's two sorts, very crudely, I was much more subtle than this, but very crudely, there's two sorts of psychological states that you can have. Long-term ones that take a long, long time to decay, and these might be personality traits, they might be long-term memories, they might be sort of deep-held values or deep-held beliefs, and they decay extremely slowly. You lose them, of course, over life, but you lose them at much lower rate than you lose, say, those very short-term memories, like the memory of having a sip of a glass of water or walking over here, something like that. And the idea is that the drop-off between your psychological connectedness between here and here is, in fact, very great, because here you have a lot of short-term memories shared with your current self that were lost by this later time. Once you get to this point, all of those short-term memories that you might have shared with this have pretty much gone. And so, moving from here to here, the only thing that you're going to retain are then in connection with this are long-term memories, but they have this very slow decay rate, and so you're likely to have a very high degree, or the psychological connectedness between here and here is likely to be very, very similar to the psychological connectedness between here and here, because anything that's lasted this long is likely to last them into the next one, whereas that's not going to be the case between these two. So Arif starts off by pointing at that. He appeals to Strutt's second theorem to show that stationarity plus the Parfitian discounting is going to be exploitable. Stationarity is rationally required, therefore Parfitian discounting is irrational. The problem is that for the Parfitian, so the problem with this argument, I'm going to agree with the conclusion, but an amended version, the problem with this argument is that stationarity, we've no reason to think if we're Parfitians that stationarity is going to be required. Stationarity would require the following thing, that the drop-off in my psychological connectedness between these two and these two is going to be the same as between these two and these two. That's just what stationarity said. It pays no attention to date. And when Arif tries to motivate this, it sounds very plausible, because he sort of says, well, how could it possibly be that the date alone would make any sort of difference to the rate at which you discount the future? But of course, if you're Parfit, it doesn't have to be the date that's doing the work. It could be what's going on for you at the particular time. So for instance, suppose on the 1st of January 2018, bad choice of date, but I was just going to work. Okay? Whereas on the 1st of January 2019, I was getting married. Okay. In that case, here you would expect me not to really remember very much about this day, sort of the next day or the day after. I won't remember reasonable amounts of it, but kind of just ordinary sorts of things, sort of ordinary experience of walking around, looking at the sky, looking at the pavement. So I'm not really going to remember. Whereas on a day which is extremely important to me, a day which has this kind of great emotional peak, I'm going to have a lot more retention of short-term memories between these two. So for the Parfitian, it looks like stationarity is not going to hold, and for quite principled reasons of the sort Parfit gets. Okay, however, it looks like it doesn't really matter, because if discounting is Parfitian, it's going to turn out the fact that time consistency is also going to be often violated. Okay, and that is in fact enough to make you exploitable. Okay, so what does that mean? It just means that the difference between the connectedness of these two and the connectedness of these two should be the same as the difference between the connectedness of these two and these two. And that's what time consistency requires. And you can see why that may well not be the case in a Parfitian set. Okay, so, okay. Right, so, finally, a couple of slides. So what does this show? So one problem with this, so why am I interested in this question? It looks like if Ari's right, then it's going to provide a counterexample to the sort of judgment aggregation solution I'm proposing. Because I'm proposing that you should give differential weight to your different future selves based on, well, and also your past selves, but I'm thinking more here about future selves, according to your psychological connectedness, and that's your overlap. So I'm sort of taking on the Parfitian suggestion in this particular case, but Arif seems to show that if you take on that, then you're going to end up exploitable, and therefore you're going to end up irrational, and that doesn't look like a good solution to a problem for decision-making. Okay, so what do we do about this? Well, I'm going to go with an ill-advised route of denying 50 years of economics and suggest that, in fact, exploitability doesn't imply irrationality. Why is that? Well, I think this is... I mean, one way to... Okay, so here's the general explanation, and I'll give a couple of examples, and I'll finish. So what does exploitability actually say? And I think when you spell it out, you begin to see why it might not be such a bad thing. So exploitability essentially says... The quantifiers are important here. Suppose you violate a particular norm, then there exist very particular decision problems that I can describe for you in which you will make decisions that are bad, and they're in fact predictably bad, that you could have known ahead of time would end up being bad. That's what exploitability says. I can, given the preferences that you in fact have, there is a particular decision problem I can present to you, such that you will make a choice on that decision problem that you could know in advance will in fact be bad. But the problem is that that only shows that these preferences do badly when it comes to those very particular decision problems. It doesn't tell us anything about how they do when it comes to other sorts of decision problems. So essentially it's saying, you have these sorts of preferences, they lead you to do something very bad in very particular situations. I'm not going to tell you anything about how they do in other situations, but I'm going to conclude from this all the same that it's irrational to have them. And it just looks like that's not a good way of arguing. When we're sort of asking whether or not a particular mental state set of attitudes is rational or not, it's not enough to just identify a single bad feature of them. You've also got to ask whether it's counterbalanced by other good features. And nothing in the exploitability argument shows this. So I mean, just talk about two comparisons to give a certain amount of sense of this. So think about Dutch book arguments. Dutch book arguments are supposed to tell us why our degrees of belief should be probabilistic. And the way they do that is they say, and they're very controversial, I think there's also some problems with them, but let's agree with them on all sorts of assumptions they make, and grant them that they do establish this. If your degrees of belief aren't probabilistic, then you're exploitable. If they are probabilistic, then you're not exploitable. And this alone is supposed to show that you should have probabilistic degrees of belief. But the problem is that what that shows is if you're not probabilistic, there are certain decision problems that I can cook up and describe for you, that were you to face them, you would make choices that are bad within those very particular decision problems. But of course, it could be that by having these non-probabilistic degrees of belief, you do very, very well in other sorts of decision problems. The Dutch book on its own doesn't tell us anything about how you do with respect to those others, and so it doesn't tell you whether there's any counterbalancing consideration. Okay. And here's another sort of case. So the preface paradox, and I look here, it's going down a controversial solution today. In the preface paradox case, you end up believing each assertion that you make in a book, but you also believe that their conjunction isn't true because you're assuming those. At least one of them is going to be false. It's a big book. You've made some mistakes and you're fallible. So the standard sort of thing is to say, look, if your beliefs, degrees of belief are, sorry, if your beliefs are inconsistent, you're guaranteed to have false beliefs. If they're consistent, you're not guaranteed to have false beliefs. Therefore, it's irrational to have inconsistent degrees of belief. But this seems to suffer from exactly the same problem. There's no way, it doesn't tell you anything about the possible counterbalancing effects of having inconsistent beliefs. And in the preface paradox, it looks like there are counterbalancing effects. So consider this set of possible beliefs. I believe all of these different propositions in my book, and I also believe that they're not true. Now, it's true that it's guaranteed that at least one of those will be false. But it's also guaranteed, or not guaranteed, but it's also quite possible that a lot of them will be true. And if you consider the alternative beliefs that you might have in a preface case, it looks like you're going to give up that possibility. So, for instance, suppose, the standard thing people suggest you do instead is that you suspend belief on all of these propositions and perhaps believe this. In that situation, you give up all of these true beliefs that you might have had. The possibility of having, if you've got any possibility of having this large number of true beliefs, this is the only belief you actually have, and so that's the only one that could end up being true. You give up this possibility of having all these true beliefs just in order to avoid the guaranteed, having at least one guaranteed false belief. And so this looks like a situation where you have something that is guaranteed to have some bad feature, but by having that thing that's guaranteed to have that bad feature, you also open up the possibility to yourself of having a whole bunch of good features, which you don't have if you do the other thing that's suggested. And so I'm suggesting that in these cases, these exploitability cases, really what you've got to do in order to establish, say, that you should have 10 consistent discounting rates, is not that, you, to show that they're irrational, it's not enough to show just that they're exploitable. You also have to show that there's some alternative that is going to do better in some sense. It's going to be expected to do better, or on average does better, or something like that. And that's what we don't have here, so that's supposed to be a solution to the problem that Arif has raised. Perfect. Okay, thank you very much.